A Different Kind of Leader captures insights from diverse leaders in healthcare, public health, and academic settings so that our organizations are in a stronger position to grow, innovate, and meet the challenges of our day. To our listeners, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, this is Giselle Corby Smith, host of A Different Kind of Leader. I am thrilled to be able to spend some time with Dr. Sandro Galea, a physician, epidemiologist, and author, dean, and the Robert A. Knox Professor at Boston University School of Public Health. He's previously held academic and leadership positions at Columbia, the University of Michigan, the New York Academy of Medicine. He's published extensively in the peer-reviewed literature and is a regular contributor to a range of public media about the social causes of health, mental health, and the consequences of trauma. In particular, in the midst of this pandemic, he has been an important voice to underscore the epidemiologic as well as the human toll of this pandemic. He's listed as one of the most widely cited scholars in the social sciences. He chairs the board of the Association of Schools and Programs of Public Health, is the past president of the Society of Epidemiologic Research, and of the Interdisciplinary Association for Population Health Science. He is an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. Galea has received several Lifetime Achievement Awards and holds a medical degree from the University of Toronto, graduate degrees from Harvard, Columbia, and an honorary doctorate from the University of Glasgow. Sandros, thank you so much for joining us today. I am so thrilled to have a chance to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You and I overlapped just for, I think, a couple of months on the advisory council for the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. And it was a pleasure to be able to share that brief time together. So I'm particularly looking forward to this conversation today. As we ask every guest, I'm going to ask you for a quote that embodies your leadership style. It's a quote that you've carried with you through your career or just one that you really enjoy. Can you tell us a quote that you'd want to share with us?
Yes, may I share two?
You can share as many as you want.
Because I actually am a big fan of collecting quotes from other people that have guided me. So I'll share two. I'll start with a big picture one, which is attributed to Thomas Edison, although who knows who really said it, which is vision without execution is hallucination. I've always really liked that because I've always felt there's a lot of leadershipiness that sort of articulates vision and it's very outward looking and sets a pretty picture. But I've experienced a number of occasions where you observe leaders and you're like, well, the vision's nice, but nothing's actually happening. So I've always thought it was important to say vision without execution is hallucination. And I think a leader needs to bring vision and execution. So that's the big picture one. At a more granular level, the other quote comes from an unlikely, perhaps, leadership guru who is Pope John the 23rd, who said, see everything, tolerate much, correct a little. And I've always really liked that as a prescription for the granular day-to-day of leadership, because I think it's important for leadership to really see everything, but to have the self-restraint and wisdom to let a lot of things go, and then to correct a little, consistent, of course, with the vision.
I love that. I love both of those quotes, actually. I've hallucinated quite a lot and learned to needing to actually have a little bit more implementation in my work. Lots of great ideas that need some structure to them. But in particular, that last quote really embodies a book that I just purchased that the title is What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And one of the things that this author talks about undoing is the need to comment on everything, the need to correct folks, and the need to show people how smart you are. So could you say, well, just to go back to the title of that book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. How did you get to where you are now? Tell us a little bit about your trajectory, how you came to be in the space you are now.
I'm often asked that, particularly by students, and unfortunately, my story is entirely accidental. I immigrated to North America to go to university. And I went straight to medical school because that's what you do when you sort of immigrate to do health. And I became a doctor and practiced medicine until I was about 30 when I realized this is actually not the right match for me. So then I went back to graduate school and started all over. And then I've been in academic public health since. And so that was pretty accidental, really. Like I went to the medicine, then I went to public health. So my path was I started my career at the New York Academy of Medicine, where I really worked while I was doing my my doctoral training. And I had the good fortune of working with a mentor who allowed me to work while doing my PhD. And then I kept working there. And then I moved to the University of Michigan, where I went up the academic ladder and had the privilege of starting the Center for Global Health. And then it turned out that Columbia University Epidemiology Department, where I had done my doctorate, they were looking for a chair, and I sort of accidentally happened to be the right person for that position. So I went back there. And then I've been in this current position now for about, I'm in my seventh year as dean at Boston University, because this position opened up and they were kind enough to want me to do it. So I wish I could say there was a grand plan behind any of it. But the truth of the matter was that I moved to public health really from a vision perspective, from a mission perspective, because I really resonated with the mission of public health. And then I had the good fortune of doing both an academic public health career and having these leadership positions that I have been hopefully the right person, right place at the right time for, which I think a lot of leadership really is about that, is about the right person match with the right position at the right time.
Yeah, I would counter that luck is opportunity meeting preparation.
I like that. I like that.
And so, you know, it took, I would imagine, at that point where you pivoted to go back to school to get your doctoral degree, a certain amount of awareness, a self-awareness. You talked about the resonance with the mission of public health. Can you say a little bit more about that decision?
Yeah, so I was trained as a physician, and I did residency in primary care and emergency medicine. And I was practicing in Northern Canada and in some remote parts of the world. I did some work in Somalia, some work in Papua New Guinea, some work in the Philippines. And, you know, when you're a physician practicing in these areas, you do a lot of good. You really do a lot of good with your hands. Like, literally, you are helping people day to day. You're keeping people alive day to day. So it's really very much the essence of what medicine does and the impact it makes. But I couldn't shake the feeling that I was like the proverbial, you know, man at the side of the river, like, you know, seeing somebody drowning, jumping in and saving her, seeing somebody else drowning, jumping in and saving him, seeing somebody else drowning, jumping in and saving them. And I wasn't stopping to say, well, who's throwing them in the river to begin with? And I started thinking, there must be a better way. There must be a better way. And I don't know what that is. I wasn't trained for it. I wasn't trained for it in medicine. So I really went back to school to do public health because of an inkling that I might find what it is in public health. So that's actually why I went back to school. So in terms of you say about the self-awareness, I think the awareness was that I went into medicine. I always knew I was going to be a doctor. I was always told I was going to be a doctor. I always cared about health. But I realized once I became a doctor and was doing all this medical stuff, that what I really cared about was keeping people healthy, not curing them once they're already sick. Okay. And that I did not know. My first 30 years of my life, I did not know any of that. And that's when I pivoted and I said, I need to learn what that is.
I think for many of us that are physicians that become dissatisfied or frustrated, maybe not dissatisfied, but more frustrated with the limits
of what.
Yeah.
Yes. And sometimes I'm misunderstood on this, you know, because sometimes people say, I don't mean this, it's not an anti-medicine comment at all. I mean, medicine is critical. And I often tell students, you know, when I have a heart attack, I need a good doctor to look after my heart attack. That's what a doctor does. I just realized that a broader perspective on keeping people healthy and understanding that doing something about that was more consonant with where my heart was. And I realized that it was a big step. It was a big step. And so I immigrated to go to college in Canada. I did medicine in Canada, residency in Canada. And at the time, there were no real graduate programs in public health in Canada. So I had to immigrate to this country again, which, you know, it was not a fun experience the first time. So it wasn't fun the second time either. So it was a big deal to say, I want to follow where I think my heart is.
Yeah. That purpose-driven kind of decision, I think, is just so instructive for all of us. And so powerful to have the presence of mind. I imagine that there are physicians, people, I should say, who care as deeply as you describe that sort of resonates with me, that want to care for people, but don't maybe either have been exposed or don't have the necessarily even the presence of mind to say, I need to do something differently. One of the things in your trajectory that has been revealed sort of full force is this breach between our health system and public health in this pandemic. That the very things that we asked people, individuals, to do to protect themselves and their communities actually may be exacerbating their chronic conditions.
Well, you know, let's talk about the pandemic for a second. I know we don't want to spend the whole time talking about the pandemic, but let's...
like every interview.
And this is... No, I'm sure, Giselle. And this is, of course, where you and I intersected around the National Institute of Minority Health Disparities. But the response to the pandemic has been an extraordinary triumph of biomedical science. We, as a country, have invested a lot in biomedical science, and we have reaped their reward. Like, we have developed vaccines in about 8 months, when the fastest vaccine before ever was 4 years. We reduced the mortality from COVID in hospital fourfold within just a few months. That is an extraordinary triumph. Unfortunately, it was a failure of everything else. And everything else is how we structure our world, that we have unevenly distributed assets that create haves and have-nots, health haves and health have-nots, and those became reflected in the results of the pandemic. So in the pandemic, we've talked a lot about, of course, nationally, about the disproportionate burden among people of color, and that is a direct reflection of the disproportionate burden of poor health before the pandemic. So the pandemic didn't really create these things. It simply elevated them to our attention. So I think leadership around the moment needs to say, well, we now see this very clearly. I mean, now many people saw it clearly before, but okay, now we all see it collectively as a country, and now we should fix that. Because if all we do after this pandemic is invest billions of dollars in biosurveillance systems and drugs, again, that's important. But if that's all we fix, the next pandemic will hit and we'll have the same problems.
Yeah. What advice would you give leaders now about what needs to be done differently, or how to even capitalize, if that's the right term, on this public health crisis so that we're not in that same position again?
I think we simply need to recognize that the moment calls for elevating the importance of removing health haves and health have-nots once and for all, of leveling the playing field that creates equitable health across socioeconomic groups, across racial groups. And the underlying fault lines are socioeconomic and racial ethnic. And the two, of course, are intertwined like a braid, but they are two distinct fault lines. And the lesson is that those fault lines will trip us up again, or we'll fall into them again. Anytime the next pandemic happens, it doesn't matter how much money we invest in biosurveillance and in therapeutics. So I think there is an opportunity for leadership to make this point and to elevate this point and to use the pandemic as impetus to fix underlying structural issues that we haven't dealt with in a long time. Now, this is, in full disclosure, this is the entire subject of my book coming out in November.
Yes.
So the book is called, if I may just talk about it for 2 seconds, it's called The Contagion Next Time, which of course is an homage to The Fire Next Time. And that book is a searing portrait of racism in America. And the book's not only about racism, it's about many of these forces that we're talking about. But the point I'm trying to make in the book is that unless you deal with these underlying forces, including racism, then you actually are going to have the exact same problem when we have the next pandemic. And I'm putting out that book intentionally expecting there's going to be dozens and dozens and dozens of books about the need for better biological responses to the pandemic. And that's okay. That's important. But I want to make sure that we have voices out there who talk about the other aspects that we need to fix before the next pandemic.
Excellent. And November is when your book is coming out. I'm so looking forward to that. What advice would you give to leaders, rising leaders, emerging leaders at this moment in time? These are turbulent times. How, based on your career, would you have prepared?
Yeah. Look, it's a tough time to be a leader. It really is. I think if I were to give advice to somebody who's thinking about leadership at this moment in time, I'd say, just hold off a little bit.
Just wait a couple of years.
This is my real advice. I think the question of advice is, it really centers around, well, what is it that makes leadership? I mean, what is it that makes a good leader? And, I'm actually deeply uncomfortable talking about leadership because I feel like the two aspects in my life that I feel like I'm constantly failing at are leadership and parenting. And I feel that both of those I'm constantly doing not as well as I want to do. So I'm deeply uncomfortable about it. And I really come down to, well, what do I know? What have I learned in these jobs? And I think four things have sort of stuck with me that one needs. And in no particular order, number one, I think, is integrity. I think integrity is a very difficult word. It's hard to define. But I think what it means is wholeness of self, giving oneself to the mission and to the job, and doing so consistent with a core set of values that one does not deviate from. I think that's fundamentally what it means. And I do think that is really important. Somebody once said to me that, you know, leadership is about taking a beating and not losing your soul. And I think integrity means knowing what your soul is. So I think that's number one. Number two, and perhaps number two is the one that's really risen most to the surface in time of pandemic, is compassion. And I think one learns in leadership that it is so much better to be charitable about people's intentions and about what people aim to do and people are trying to do, and particularly when people are doing things that complicate the leadership mission. And it's hard. It's really hard to be compassionate. And I elevated there because I think it requires an act of will and an act of discipline to find compassion in leadership. That's number two.
There's a magnanimity about it, right? It's a willingness to sort of, particularly under the strain of leadership, to put your needs and potentially emotional responses to the side and really consider someone else's. So that compassion.
Absolutely. I think it absolutely is. And it is not easy. And it is, I find it's entirely trained. Like, it requires discipline to do it. Like, it doesn't just happen. It requires discipline. I think number three, which of course also elevated in time of pandemic, is hard work. Actually, like, good leadership is really hard work. Like, it takes a lot of time. It takes time thinking about the present, thinking about the future, thinking about the past, mapping things out. And I see it all the time in institutions. And you can tell where the leader is doing hard work and not. I actually would take it at a very simple level. To restaurants, for example, just these restaurants, an analogy. Now, of course, it's a pandemic. None of but if you just bear with me in the thought exercise, when we used to go to restaurants regularly, right? You can always tell a restaurant where the person in charge, whoever that is paying attention and doing the hard work of paying attention, because things don't slip, or if something slips, somebody apologizes. And I say that because it's a shared experience. You know, we all go to restaurants and you can tell when the person in charge is paying attention. And I think all of leadership is like that. So that's number three, hard work. And number four, which I never know exactly how number four fits in, but I'll put it in the end with, is self-restraint, which this goes back to my Pope John aphorism. A lot of leadership is about the self-restraint, about not jumping in, not doing, not correcting, letting things play out. And of course, the self-restraint, if I told you the only thing that matters is self-restraint, then you should laugh at me. But self-restraint coupled with the integrity, the hard work, and the compassion that makes a difference. And because if it's just self-restraint, then it's like, well, you're not doing anything, you're just sitting on the couch. But coupled with the other pieces, I think that's where it becomes powerful. So I feel like, you know, you asked me what advice would I give. I suppose the advice I would give would be, do you want to do those four things? Do you want to do the work that's involved? Because if you don't, you shouldn't do it. You know, the upsides of it, leadership, are you get paid a little bit more, and it's never worth it. It's like, it's not worth it for the hard work you have to do for the other four things. So the question is this how you wish to live your life? And if it is, then it's great. Then it's great. You know, nobody really should ever be forced into leadership. So ultimately, you have to say to yourself, I'm choosing this. I am choosing to do this. And if I'm choosing to do this, then I'm choosing to impose that discipline upon myself.
Super powerful. It's really, I think those four points really distill down the highly effective leadership, and that it's the intentionality that you bring in, that even being able to create that framework, I think is just so powerful and really is a window into who you are as a leader. Thank you for that. I'm definitely going to be carrying that with me. Did you participate in any formal leadership training?
No, I really have not, which is probably to my detriment. Over the years, I have had sort of leadership guides and consultants who have helped me with particular phases of leadership. For example, when I first started this job in creating a strategy map for the school, I thought it was important I get somebody to help guide me on that who has done that process before, because I had never done it before. And so I've had that before. And I've also used some leadership consultants and sort of brought them in for leadership teams to do sort of to help the leadership team get better and focused. But I've never done, you know, I don't have an MBA. I've never done formal leadership training that way. The one thing perhaps I've done is I've observed a lot and I've taken a lot of notes. And that's why when you asked me about quotes, I said, well, actually I have a whole document of many quotes, because I have tried to collect ideas about what to my mind constitutes good leadership. And I think I've learned from observing good leadership and not good leadership. And I try to keep learning and keep observing all the time. And that's an instruction in and of itself.
Absolutely. I think that to me, that's sort of fundamental, that a willingness to continue to learn as a leader, even when you've reached the sort of levels that you have.
I mean, fundamentally, it's interesting, it's emerging in our conversation. Leadership is an act of discipline, right? Like the discipline is non-negotiable. And if it is discipline, then you get better with being more careful about what you're disciplining. And sometimes I use with mentees the marathon analogy, and to say you can have two people and they both have whatever, some sort of some predisposition for running, right? That's fine. But we all know that the person who's disciplined, who does the hard work, who exercises every day, who runs every day, that person is going to be a much faster runner. And in no time at all, the person who had the same perhaps proclivity, who doesn't do any of that, is going to be left behind, right? Mm-hmm. And I think difficult, complex human tasks like leadership are just like that, that they require constant discipline. You know, when in this job, one habit of mine that I got into when I first started, which isn't perhaps very soul satisfying, but I found it very helpful, is at the end of every day, in my drive home, I would say, what three mistakes did I make today? As I said, it doesn't make you feel necessarily very good. That's why I try to get it out of the way while I'm driving. By the time I get home and see my kids, I'm done with that. But I found it, and I still do it on a semi-regular basis, because I think it's important. I think it's important to ask myself, what could I have done better? And that involves, of course, in leadership, some conversation, some exchange, some email, some small decision. You know, on any given day, you're not doing big things. I think on any given day, you're doing small incremental things. But I find it important to think about that, reflect on it. And of course, try not to do it again. When I start saying, wait, I'm doing the same mistake I made last week and week before, then you know you're in trouble. So you try to make different mistakes.
Well, your last comments about being that sort of intentionality every day to reflect and create that pivot in terms of who you are and what you bring as a leader reminds me of the book Atomic Habits. Have you, James Clear?
Yeah, I've heard about it.
He talks about the atom being sort of that smallest essence of matter, and that sometimes it takes that the smallest change over time.
That's interesting. That's super interesting.
Yeah. And so the analogy that you raise about running, it's not so much their initial ability or athletic prowess. It's the every day being intentional about going a little farther, doing a little bit more. And he uses the analogy at the beginning of his book, where he talks about just two airplanes leaving one coast and going to another. If they're off by just 1 or 2 or 3 degrees, can end up in such different places. And so the difference can start small, but it's compounded over time.
Funny you say that, because I've often used the story in public health now around two boats. I often use the two boats, that what public health does is it introduces a small part of a degree difference between the direction of the two boats. And it's very small and you don't see it. But over time, of course, the boats diverge and go in very different directions in water. So I've used that metaphor for public health. I've never thought of it in terms of leadership, but I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, James Clear probably was in one of your lectures and then just pirated your example.
It's very powerful, because we often don't think about that. And public health is useful, right? Because So much of what public health does is invisible and it's small. And you get students coming to public health and they want to change the world. And my answer is absolutely, you will change the world, but you have to be comfortable with the fact that you're going to make a very small change and the impact is going to be over time. It's going to be big over time. But you have to accept the fact that in the present, it's a very small change.
And that to me is, it's sort of the duality of that kind of small and intentional and targeted change in the midst of this sort of cataclysmic kinds of changes that we're seeing and being called for in our society now. And that it's a both and. We need both of those. We need sort of that sort of steady, sure, and directed kind of change that we know over time will bring some of those arcs back together so that we have that equity, and also the need for sort of cataclysmic change, the kind of change that this pandemic represents an opportunity for as well.
Absolutely.
Well, we're almost at the end of our time together, and so I'm going to take us to the, this went very quickly. I'm going to take us to the questions we ask all of our guests. The first is, what do you do for self-care?
Yeah, so I have two kids, and a lot of my time is spent either at work or with kids, but the thing I'd really like to do is read. I read a lot, and I always read fiction, actually, right? Like reading fiction, because I feel like it transports me. So that probably is my happy place where I spend that. If I can spend 20 minutes a day just transporting myself to middle ages or to different countries, different settings, it makes me very happy. And I've always made an effort to read broadly, to like not to read any genre and to read different authors, different identities, different nationalities, to push myself to see the world that way.
What are you reading now?
So I'm just finishing Hamnet, which is by Maggie O'Farrell, which is a wonderful book. It's a historical fiction book. I don't particularly love historical fiction, although I really liked Hilary Mantel's Cromwell trilogy. And it is about William Shakespeare's son, Hamnet, who died of the plague. And it's a beautiful book. It's a very lyrical book. And the author, I've never read anything by her before, has a wonderful eye and ear for conveying the world of the 16th century, and using this device, this terrible device of a child dying in sort of at the heart of the book to help you understand what the world was like then. So I'm really enjoying it. Actually, I should be finishing it tonight. Last night I looked at the number of pages I have left, and I'm actually excited to finish that tonight.
I have tried to read like 20 minutes to an hour each day. I am a voracious reader, and that I just devour books. And so it's really hard because to do that requires many hours, which often takes me into the early morning in terms of reading.
That's how it works for me as well.
Yeah. So I usually have a stack ready for either the weekend or when I'm on vacation. So tell me, what is your favorite leadership book or a book that you would recommend to others?
Yeah. So I don't actually have a favorite leadership book, but I have over time collected bits and pieces of books. I've taken pieces from books, and I literally have a file called To Live By. And I have over the years taken pieces and elements, and I cut and paste them, and I go back to the file and I read it. So I have essays and pieces from other people. So I don't really have a leadership book to recommend. I mean, I've used different leadership books for different things, and I've used them with our leadership team for different purposes, but I wouldn't come down on any one book.
I love that. I just love the name of your file, To Live By.
Well, it is declarative. It is exactly what the file is.
What do you think separates good leaders from great leaders?
Oh, it's such a good question. I think it is the things that we've talked about in this interview. I might come back to where we really started, which is vision and execution. I actually, vision and execution are such different parts of your brain. Like envisioning a beautiful image of what an institution should be like and how we are all, what we're all going to be like when we're there. I can almost physically feel it. I can almost physically feel like a different part of my brain lighting up than the execution part, which says, okay, who's going to do what, when, what steps are going to be taken. And I actually think that great leaders need to be able to do both. I actually think they need to be able to do both. I think you can be very good at one or the other. And if you're just doing one or the other, you can be very good, but you're not going to be great.
Excellent. And what advice would you give to your younger self?
Do more yoga.
That's actually great advice.
That's what you wish you had done.
Exactly. That's exactly what you would. Literally this morning, I was thinking like, gosh, what happened to that commitment to do more yoga?
Exactly. If I could be my 30-year-old self, I'd say do yoga every day. And yes, when you're over 50.
So true. Fantastic. Thank you so much for this time today, Sandra. This was just a wonderful opportunity to spend just a few minutes with you. Just so much wisdom that you've offered. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Well, Giselle, thank you so much. Thank you for doing this and thank you for inviting me. It's really a privilege to be here.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us and special thanks to Dr. Sandro Galea. You can find Dr. Galea on Twitter at Sandro Galea. Check out the link in the show notes for his upcoming book, The Contagion Next Time, which is available for pre-order and releases November 2021. On the next episode of Season 3 of A Different Kind of Leader, we'll be hearing from Dr. Margaret Moss, a member of the 3 affiliated tribes of North Dakota and the first and only American Indian to hold both nursing and Juris Doctorates. This episode was edited by DeAndre Sawyer. Many thanks to the DKL production team with host Giselle Corby-Smith, executive producer Sable Watson, producer and creative director Rachel Quito, production assistants Jamie Eid, DeAndre Sawyer, and Shelby McLam, and music by Mixout and Chill Out Lounge. Visit our website at differentkindofleader.com to find resources for your leadership toolkit and check out previous podcast episodes of our guest leaders. And if you've liked what you've heard, please rate us and leave a comment wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps others to find us. Like and comment on Facebook and Instagram at Different Kind of Leader, all one word, as well as on Twitter at DK Leadership. As always, we want to hear from you, our listeners, so please contact us at differentkindofleader@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. This is A Different Kind of Leader.